As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello and welcome to the Forum Club. I'm Bill Oram, joined by Anthony Slater and Jovan Buha. Lakers coming off a loss to the Golden State Warriors on Monday night, Martin Luther King Day, hitting the road for a big road trip that starts on Thursday in Milwaukee. Guys, we're going to go deep on this Warriors game today, I think, because I think we learned a lot about the Lakers, saw some things we hadn't seen before. Can you each give me one takeaway, though, from that loss, the Lakers' fourth loss of the season?
Oh, man, I got about 95 takeaways, but most of them are from the Warriors' angle. How about from the Lakers' side, both AD and LeBron go 6-16 shooting? And I would say the Warriors will not be a playoff threat to the Lakers, but I think that formula for bothering the Lakers is having enough defenders who bother those two into occasional inefficient nights, combo inefficient nights. The Lakers are going to struggle to win games where neither of them go off. And, you know, the Warriors had Wiggins and Oubre tag team and LeBron and Draymond, I thought was good down the stretch on Davis. And that, you know, I don't, again, that's, the Clippers are probably the supercharged version of that, of what they can do on their best nights defensively against those two, with Ibaka, would have Davis and some help there. And then obviously Kawhi, PG as the wing combo on LeBron. So maybe that's probably my largest takeaway, like how quiet those two were.
The only thing I would add to that was it felt like, and you know, they said this post game that they were settling for a lot of jumpers. And I went back and watched the last like 5-6 minutes of the game. And it felt like, especially with AD, there were a couple times where he might have had a lane had he chose to drive, and he just settled for the step back, the contested jumper. And we see that with him at times, and I think that's kind of AD at his worst, is, you know, he is so talented, he has so many weapons offensively, that it is just a matter of, you know, how do you want to attack? And for him, especially to start this season, he has not been driving as much, he has not been taking as many shots in the paint. And I think, you know, for the most part, it works because he is such a good jump shooter. But on a night like tonight, where his jump shot isn't falling, or, you know, last night, rather, where his jump shot's not falling, you know, that ends up being the result. For me, I think what the Lakers are quickly learning is that bench unit of Montrezl Harrell, Markieff Morris, LeBron James, Kyle Kuzma, and Wesley Matthews just does not work. It has a minus 32.2 net rating in 44 minutes. They've been outscored by 26 points over those 44 minutes. And I think what the Lakers need to do moving forward is they cannot have a lineup that only has one of LeBron, AD, Dennis, Mark, THT, or Caruso. Like, you need at least two of those ball handlers and playmakers out there. If you only have one of those guys, you are going to struggle. And that's what we've seen with that group. It only has an 83 offensive rating, which is just abysmal. You know, that's by far, you know, would be worse than the league. So that group has really struggled.
In 1983, that would be the worst in the league.
Exactly. I mean, that group has just been getting destroyed by benches. And you would think a LeBron-led bench unit would be good, and you know, that was the Lakers recipe last season, what was these LeBron bench led bench units, but they have not been as good this season when LeBron is the only ball handler out there.
Well, last year's bench unit had more ball handling, if you assume that yeah, is with Rajon Rondo.
I was gonna say, are we about to get a Rajon Rondo tribute here? He was good in the playoffs. Man, remember Rondo in the playoffs?
I do remember Rondo in the playoffs, but last year we had to have an emergency pod in like November when Frank Vogel said he expected Rondo to play 25 minutes a game because that felt so dangerous. And then it ends up being, of course, a big part of the reason they win the championship. So, which also, I guess, speaks to not overreacting to things that happen in November. And this is currently the November of this season. You know what stuck out to me last night, guys, and then we can keep kicking it around. First time we've seen the Lakers lose their composure, I think, all year. And listen, things have been going well for them. They've been rolling. They'd won four straight games by at least 17 points. They were on their way again last night, but you could really see it kind of coming apart at the seams for that one night. You know, they weren't getting calls. Schroeder had three quick fouls in the third quarter. Vogel gets the tee. I thought he was going to get tossed, but he managed to summon some restraint and avoid that. You saw LeBron snap at KCP, after he passed up an open three on the perimeter, and then LeBron against the shot clock ended up traveling. It just was the first time that I thought you really kind of saw the Lakers sort of disintegrate in terms of, you know, their composure and kind of their mindset. And, you know, I mean, listen, doesn't matter. I mean, I think I still have championship fatigue where I'm having a hard time getting too worked up about anything that happens in game 15. But, you know, when you see something that's new, that gets my attention. And it's like, that is something that is there, and at least that, you know, they are capable of. And so, you know, that's one of those things that you try to, you know, focus on and draw attention to and learn a lesson from.
Yeah. Me and Jovan talked about it a little bit on the podcast. It's something the Lakers are going to have to deal with all season, where that specific regular season game on whatever night typically matters a lot less to them than the other team. You know, the Lakers get up early by what, 19, and it's like, all right, like, let's just kind of cruise to the finish line and not have to exert a bunch of effort. And even when the Warriors are storming back, it's like, well, even if they lose, whatever. Again, like, it's not, we're not judging anything. Like, the Lakers losing last night doesn't make us question whether they're the best team in the West. Whereas on the other side, the Warriors, like, that is a huge win. That's a momentum builder. Potentially, that's like, you know, every single result has seedings implications in a crowded Western Conference under the LA teams. So it's sometimes tough to regain your composure and regain a hunger to go chase a win when the other team just has so much more on the line. And, you know, I think this will motivate the Lakers to go play the Bucks well, I think, Thursday night. But, you know, again, when they're playing like the Spurs, for example, right? They kind of had some struggles even on, what did they go, like 2-1 in those three games against the Spurs?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. But those were thornier games than you probably expected them to be, because the Spurs just had more desperation, understandably. And that's, I think, just something they're going to have to, you just kind of got to deal with it, because that's just the reality of their situation.
I have a question for you guys. With the loss, the Lakers are now 7-0 on the road and 4-4 at Staples. And to me, I think if you look at the schedule and the schedule breakdown, the Lakers' four toughest games this season have all been at Staples. I would say the Clippers, the Mavericks, the Blazers, and now this Warriors team. And they're 1-3 in those games. And I don't want to overreact. And like you guys said, you know, it's not a, you know, kind of you know, changing their place in the West. But I do think it's interesting that they've rolled the teams that are below 500. I mean, the Spurs beat them once, but, you know, the Rockets, the Thunder, the Grizzlies, the Spurs in San Antonio, like, they've beaten those teams and crushed some of them. But the teams that have been above 500, you know, the teams that we expect to see in the playoffs, again, they're 1-3 against those teams at Staples. And I'm just curious if you guys, you know, make anything of that. Is that just they're still finding their footing? They're not, you know, their foot isn't on the gas pedal as hard as it should be maybe at this point. But like, that to me would be the only thing that's slightly concerning, is that when they've actually faced a team that they might see in the playoffs, they have struggled or lost that game.
Well, it's more difficult to come to LA and get very drunk and then eventually hung over if none of the bars or restaurants are open. So maybe they're losing a significant portion of that home court advantage. Also, no,
that has not been my experience over the last year, by the way.
You know how NBA teams are? They come in, they're like, wow, we're in LA, sun and fun, and oh, I love this restaurant, I have to go to this restaurant, even though it's the night before the game. And then maybe they're a little sluggish, they're carrying that big steak dinner with five cocktails the night before into the game. And you just can't do that anymore. You just got to sit in your hotel and stew and wait for the game and watch film and prepare. I'm probably overrating that, but I don't know.
I'm pretty sure my corner liquor store would deliver to the Ritz-Carlton. I'll alert the league.
It's less desirable for a lot of these NBA players to get hammered if they have to do it alone in their hotel room. That's all I'm saying. I mean, they want to
yet
go
again
out.
That has not been my experience.
Well, your experience might be different than NBA superstars, I must say.
How dare you?
But I would say generally home court advantage is not as important right now. You know, they're 7-0 on the road, whatever, at home. Like, there's no fans anywhere really, so it's not really tangible to know that impact, but that might have something to do with it.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service that you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Fans and crowd noise have been on my mind a lot lately because I just wrote a story that went up today about the Lakers' fake crowd noise operation and the people who are kind of behind it and how it works. But Anthony Davis was asked about going on the road and why road teams across the league are winning at such a higher rate. And, you know, he really leaned into the absence of the fans and, you know, the fact that the home team doesn't have, you know, that energy to draw on. And that basically makes every game a toss-up. And, you know, I think there probably is something to that. Also, if you're a road team, you are 100% in work mode the entire trip, more so than ever. You know, whether it's getting hammered and going to restaurants or not, or just being able to, like, even, you know, turn off the basketball mind, because anything you do is in the context of following the league protocols and kind of having your guard up, you know, for the good of the team and the good of the league. So I do think there's probably a focus level on the road that's even more heightened than it has been in a normal season. Whereas at home, you get to see your family, you get to maybe kind of step outside of it a little bit for the first time. So I think there's a lot of factors that are specific to this season and the pandemic that might help explain or at least help us understand why the Lakers and other teams are having more success on the road. But I think Jovan, you know, kind of made a point, you know, if it's that they don't have their foot on the gas quite as much, you know, I mean, it's just not as imperative that they beat the Blazers or the Warriors in the first month of the season as it will be when they get to the playoffs. And that's a first round matchup. It's just, there will be a higher level of focus and intensity and desire when the lights are really on.
And I think that's where maybe we can transition into this road trip, because I think this is going to be telling, right? Like, because again, I think if you're looking at the current schedule, the first 15 games, I would say that, you know, the four toughest games they've had, they're 1-3 in those games. But they're going to have even tougher games coming up, you know, at Milwaukee, at Philly, at Boston. And I know we discussed this a little bit last week, but, you know, this to me is going to be kind of the barometer of how serious are they taking these games. If they reel off a 5-2 or 6-1 trip, including a couple of wins in those three harder games, that to me is like, okay, this team is starting to take things more seriously. But with the way they've played some of these games, it could also end up being something like a 3-4 or 4-3 trip. And then again, we're not really looking at them any differently, but potentially they fall down the standings. The Clippers are right there with them. Maybe they're the one seed. You know, Lakers drop to 2 or 3. So I'm just kind of interested to see how they approach this trip mentality-wise, energy-wise, and, you know, kind of how it all ends up playing out.
Yeah, I mean, the Milwaukee game in particular, which, you know, I don't know if we want to, like, preview, but that's kind of a sparkling start to it. And we like to overreact to things. So I do think if coming off a Warriors loss, they go into Milwaukee and lay a dud, and, like, Giannis looks really good, and maybe Jrue Holiday has a nice defensive night, you know, switch on to LeBron at times, and Giannis is good against Davis, maybe we'll have some conversation of, like, is this Warriors or is this Lakers team different against the, you know, the top teams this year? So I'm looking forward to seeing them challenge, because what can we possibly learn from them playing, you know, the Thunder and the Bulls? Like, there's really not much. So what are you guys looking forward to most Thursday?
I think Giannis v. LeBron. You know, I think just from a narrative standpoint, you know, there's a lot of juice between those two guys, in the sense that, you know, LeBron, I think by the end of the playoffs, if you revoted MVP after the playoffs, LeBron would have won. Now, obviously, it's a regular season award, but the fact that Giannis has won it the last 2 years, the fact that Giannis won it in a year that LeBron was the runner-up, and this year LeBron has looked like an MVP, despite, you know, a lot of numbers, you know, trending downward, has still been by far the best player on the best team and has been, you know, has looked like him, like himself at 36 years old. I think there is a case gaining momentum for LeBron to win MVP this season, and a strong performance against the two-time defending MVP would certainly keep him on track for that.
For me, I think it's going to be Anthony Davis. Last year, he had 66 points across the two matchups against the Bucks. And to me, when you're looking at how the Lakers match up with the other contenders, be it the Bucks, the Nets, the Clippers, whoever else you want to throw in that mix, Anthony Davis, he's the trump card. Some of these teams have multiple guys you can throw at LeBron. Like if you're looking at the Clippers, okay, you can throw Kawhi, you can throw PG, you can maybe even throw Marcus Morris. But no one has any answer for Anthony Davis. And when Anthony Davis asserts himself, as we've seen him do during the playoffs and at times this season, like nobody can guard him. And looking at a matchup with Milwaukee, like I don't know how you approach trying to defend Anthony Davis. Do you go bigger with Brooke Lopez? Do you go smaller, a little bit smaller with Giannis, but someone who's not as strong? And but you also want probably Giannis on LeBron or Chris Middleton on LeBron. Like I don't know how you approach that if you're the Bucks. So to me, seeing how they defend AD, AD has really improved as a passer out of double teams, on the move, in the short roll. Like he's a much improved passer this season. So I think that's another wrinkle where you can't just double AD and expect him to turn the ball over or force up a shot. So I'm really intrigued to see that Davis versus the Bucks defense matchup and how they approach that.
So this is where Jrue Holiday is supposed to raise Milwaukee's ceiling. It's the reason the Bucks mortgage their future, really, for a guy who's a fringe all-star. I mean, what did they trade? Like 3 first-round picks plus pieces, you know, Bledsoe, George Hill, all that to New Orleans, because Jrue Holiday is a good, you know, side number 3 piece offensively, but what he does defensively, particularly, you know, from a versatility standpoint, where I've seen him in playoff series against the Warriors. Steph Curry says he's one of the hard, you know, toughest defenders he goes against, and Kevin Durant says that. The guy can guard a point guard and he can guard a big wing well, you know, and so I think in a Lakers matchup, if this was ever to become a playoff series, but we'll just talk about Thursday night, I think Jrue Holiday is the LeBron, you know, he gets a bulk of the LeBron task. He should, at least, because then you can bump Giannis to AD, where, you know, I think Giannis should be one of the best Davis defenders in the league. He's one of the rare guys who's, you know, almost equally as big, strong, and tall and skilled. So I actually like those two as a combo against Davis and LeBron defensively. But that's only in theory. You know, LeBron still might have a huge night. Davis might have a huge night. But I would say this, Milwaukee is better built to defend the Lakers than they were last year.
That was going to be kind of in line with something I was going to ask, which was, you know, how much more seriously do you take the Bucks as a contender this year than last year? I mean, they've been so disappointing in the last two seasons that I think when you're talking about, you know, favorites in the East, they're all, I mean, this sounds ridiculous, but it feels like they're almost easy to overlook. Like, cause there's so much about the Nets, obviously, and Boston's been tremendous. Where does Milwaukee slot in the East, and are they a more credible championship threat this year, even there, maybe if they're not as flashy of a choice?
Well, they got toasted by the Nets in their first, like, you know, in really Brooklyn's first time together without Kyrie Irving, the Nets beat them. I'd probably put Brooklyn ahead of them in the playoff pecking order right now, just because I believe in Kevin Durant more than Giannis as a playoff player. I believe in Harden more than like a Jrue Holiday, you know, as a playoff player, just because they're proven. But I would say I trust, even if Milwaukee ends up having a worse regular season record this year than last year's team, who clearly last year's Milwaukee team was built for the regular season and not the playoffs, I believe in their collection more in the playoffs, really just because Jrue Holiday. I mean, he just fits what is needed in modern day playoff basketball. At the same time, I don't know about you guys, but if I was like going down my East list, Brooklyn I would have above them. I might even have Miami, just because of what we saw Miami can do. And they pretty much brought everybody back that matters. And maybe Milwaukee third. Philadelphia is kind of frisky. We'll see. Where are you at, Jovan?
I think it's Brooklyn 1A, Milwaukee 1B. I think they're right there. For me, I'm a big believer in top-end talent. And I think if you look at what Milwaukee did, they basically traded some of that depth you know, especially with like the back end of their second unit for Jrue Holiday. And that to me is an upgrade. Like I trust Jrue Holiday more than Eric Bledsoe. I trust him. You know, I think slotting him in as that third guy is much better than slotting him in as the second guy, which he was in New Orleans for so long. So I think, you know, from that perspective, they are better equipped to me to make a deep or, you know, a deeper run, you know, and maybe get to the finals. I think the one concern, you know, bigger picture is still Bud and his reluctance to adjust. And you know, that to me is kind of been the thing where even the last couple of years with Bledsoe struggles, with the bench and depth not really translating as well in the playoffs, you know, one of the bigger concerns for them has been Bud and just his inability to adjust the defense to you know, certain series or matchups and to kind of unlock a different version of Giannis. And they've, you know, kind of been predictable. But I do think, as you guys both kind of mentioned with the defense, like, to me, the difference between them and Brooklyn is I do have more confidence in Milwaukee defensively with Giannis, Middleton, Holiday, Lopez to get stops in the playoffs versus Brooklyn, where to me, their recipe is going to have to be outscoring you, and they have the personnel to do it. It might be the best collection of three ISO scorers in NBA history. But defensively, to me, there still are some clear concerns with Brooklyn that are going to have to be ironed out in the postseason.
So what you're saying about the coaching in Milwaukee, which is a Miller town, you might be saying this Bud's not for you.
I like it, Bill. Good one. So do you guys want to move on to the rest of the road trips? Like, there are interesting games, and I'm curious what you guys think a successful road trip is. You know, seven games out east mid-pandemic is not an easy thing to do. I do think there are easy wins on the trip, you know, at Chicago. Maybe not super easy. They actually kind of struggled a little bit with Chicago and Staples, but at Cleveland, who actually weirdly has like one of the best defenses in basketball. I'm confused by that. At Detroit should be the easiest win on the trip. And then at Atlanta to close it out, although that's the seventh out of seven games. Those are probably the duller matchups. You have an at Philadelphia and an at Boston on national TV. Number one, what's a success to you guys over, you know, record wise through, you know, in seven games? And then what, besides the Milwaukee game, which matchup sticks out to you most?
It's a trip that they should go 5-2 on. I mean, really, but like you said, I mean, there's a lot going on with this trip. You know, it's a long trip. You know, they haven't traveled like this. It's seven states, seven cities, seven planes, seven hotels, you know, over, I think, 12 days. So I think you could forgive, you know, a letdown loss in here somewhere. So if it's 4-3, I'm not sweating it. I mean, honestly, the answer to your question is, you know, a successful trip is getting through it with nobody getting COVID, frankly.
Not losing half the roster in the middle of the season.
Right, yeah. Right. I mean, these are this, like, you know, and I've talked to people with the Lakers when the schedule came out. Like, everyone had this circled as sort of the red flag trip, you know, where you're in all cold weather cities, you're going to be inside the entire time. And, you know, there's just some inherent risk with, you know, with the pandemic. But from a basketball standpoint, you know, if you can go 2-1 against Milwaukee, Philly, and Boston, you know, I think you'd feel really good about that. You know, those are the games that obviously you want to watch. I want to see the Lakers, you know, perform well against those other elite teams. But other than that, I mean, it's getting home safe.
Yeah, we're in agreement here. To me, the minimum for this trip is 4-3. Of course, context is going to matter in terms of injuries or COVID, but I think 4-3 at a minimum is what you should expect. I would say 5-2 or better is successful. Obviously, if they went 6-1 or 7-0, you know, that's a home run. But even if they go 4-3, but they go 2-1 or 3-0 in those Milwaukee, Philly, Boston matchups, like, that to me, you know, those are the three games that we need to be watching for. And, you know, if they blow, like, the Detroit game should be the easiest, but it's also a back-to-back. And you know, if you blow a back-to-back in Detroit, like, it's not the end of the world. You probably shouldn't happen. But if they go 2-1 in those three games and like 2-2 in the others, I'm not really sweating it. So I think I'm more just interested, how do they match up with Milwaukee? How do they match up with Philly? How do they match up with Boston? And what happens in those three games?
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
That Boston game is like, I think it's the first ABC Saturday night game of the year. Those are always fun. It's going to kind of stink to watch a Lakers-Boston ABC Saturday night in Boston with zero fans, which I guess everything is tough to watch without fans right now. But
this would be another time for me to plug my story about crowd noise available now on The Athletic.
What did you learn from that story, Bill?
I mean, just how intricate of a process it is. I mean, you've got, you know, it takes two operators for each game, both working on, you know, different machines. They are reacting to every single movement on the basketball court. You know, there's a button for ooh, there's a button for ah, there's a button that just is for, you know, cheering. There is ambient sound, which is kind of just the dull murmur that you hear, but that goes up and down. But, you know, it's interesting because the Lakers have two guys who are actually roommates who are doing it. And one of them is a former D3 player at UC Santa Cruz. And, you know, he's brought a lot of his, you know, basketball knowledge to it, where it's like, hey, you know, we need to start raising up the intensity of the crowd late in the shot clock, because there's not any other way for the players on the court other than, you know, the bench, you know, yelling out, counting down the shot clock to know that they're getting late in the shot clock if they're not looking at it and things like that. And, you know, there's some fun aspects to it where, you know, they try to mimic the Lakers crowd as much as possible, you know, bringing up the noise, you know, extra cheers when Alex Caruso checks into the game because he's such a fan favorite and always does get a louder ovation than, you know, other subs. So, it was interesting, you know, kind of to learn some of the personality behind, you know, something that doesn't frankly sound all that interesting. But it's certainly more than just putting in a CD of crowd noise and hitting play for 2 hours. I mean, it's a very detailed process.
Do you guys like the crowd noise? Because I know I have seen arguments that's like, hey, they should just tone it down, whatever. Just embrace the fact that this is a unique scenario where we could hear everything on the court, the sneakers squeaking and like old school, like almost basically pickup basketball out there. And the idea that I know like a lot of these coaches are like taking off their masks to yell at players because it's super loud in the arena still. And like, I don't know, I've seen people say, well, if they turn it down, it would be safer. But what do you guys think? I mean, Bill, it is like the intricate process that you're detailing is very interesting, but do you think it's what they should be doing?
There's a aural need for it, right? Like you can't have, you can't have a you know, a cavernous arena completely empty, like in terms, it would be so echoey, you know, with the whistles and the yelling, it would be really unpleasant. So there needs to be something, but there could just be, you know, what I just described, the murmur, the you know, sort of white noise that, you know, would really take care of that. And, you know, what's interesting is the guy who is the head of game ops for the Lakers, this guy named Matt Shelton, you know, described it as, if it's turned on, like if that murmur is turned on and you walk into the arena, you can't hear it. You don't recognize it. But if you're in the arena at the moment they turn it off, you do feel almost like the air change. And Jovan, you know, you might be able to relate to this. When the last player leaves the court after the last on-court interview, they flip the switch. And so when we're sitting there writing later at night, it is all empty. There is no sound and the noise really carries differently. So just from a need to fill that space with some sort of sound, you need something. But could you turn it down? Yes. I think the idea is you want there to be still some of those normal cues for players and people on the court, you know, a little bit of positive reinforcement after a good play, a little bit of, you know, intensity, you know, as you're in a more intense situation, so it doesn't feel so dissonant for people on the court. You know, I mean, the things that are loud to me, it's not really the crowd noise that's loud. It's the music still. It's a lot of more of what like a DJ is doing that to me makes it, you know, takes away from like the fact that you could hear more in this moment than it is the crowd noise, which is really still, to me, Jovan, you can say if you disagree, but, you know, at least at Lakers games is not overbearing at all. Like they do not turn it up at, you know, in a way that I feel like really interferes with the experience. It's more like just having kind of that familiar cue to what's going on the floor.
You just nailed what I was thinking, which is, to me, it's the music. I think the music is a little bit too loud, and I don't know, you know, maybe it's the same volume. It's just that because there are no fans, the sound is just bouncing around louder. But the only times I've had an issue with it or felt it was getting a little too overbearing was the music and just kind of how loud that has been at times. It's kind of cool because you do hear, like, there will be pockets where of silence where there's like a transition of some kind. You know, they're playing a song, then, you know, maybe they miss a shot and then it goes, you know, the opponent gets the rebound and they're leading a fast break and they're transitioning, and you hear for like a couple of seconds what it would sound like if it was just empty, and it's awesome. It is the squeaking. It is, you can hear guys calling out defensive assignments or cussing or whatever. And those are the cool moments that I would like to hear more of, selfishly, as someone who's in the arena. But I get why the league wouldn't necessarily want that. I guess, you know, I could see why maybe players or teams wouldn't want that either. But those moments have been cool, because I feel like you have been able to hear stuff, you know, more so than in previous seasons. But yeah, to me, it's just the music. I think the crowd noise is fine. I think, you know, I get the semblance of normalcy that they're trying to preserve. But to me, some of the music, you know, it does feel like they ramp it up with the music more so than the other stuff. So and it's kind of nonstop. Like even during timeouts, normally they'd be having fan giveaways or you know, different advertisements or whatever. This has just been purely, they're just blaring music the entire time, and it can be a little bit annoying when you're trying to write, trying to tweet. So that would be my only complaint, but otherwise I think it's been fine.
Jovan's got a tweet. He's got a tweet.
I was gonna say, why don't you just turn your hearing aids down, Grandpa? Jeez.
Well, the problem too, like, the music. The problem is I like the music too. So I'm like kind of bopping my head, like, you know, I'm getting into it, and it's just distracting me from work.
From these delicious tweets. You're saying the music is too good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jovan, you were in the building. Did you notice Kent Bazemore during the national anthem?
Yeah.
There was a really jazzy rendition of the national anthem, and like Kent Bazemore just couldn't like help himself. Like he was getting into it. He was bobbing. Like
Bazemore has a good time, let me tell you. As Jovan pointed out, I know you guys were in the arena, the Warriors bench has a pretty good time out there. So
they were animated last night.
Kent Bazemore has established himself as a credible basketball player since his first stint with the Warriors.
Yeah.
Although it's kind of coming full circle in a way. But like, do people still use the term Bazemoring? Is that still a thing, or did that go the way of most things in 2014?
Steph Curry still uses the term. So not a lot of people do, but he's got such a high approval rating within the Warriors fan base because he's got a high approval rating from Steph Curry. They like golf together. And yeah, Steph has a shirt where, you know, Bazemoring with like the three, like, you know, I know what you're talking about. Steph has a shirt where it's him Bazemoring on the shirt. It's very odd, but this is a Lakers podcast. Let's talk some Lakers reserves.
Hey, first of all, Kent Bazemore, we could talk about Kent Bazemore's Laker tenure and the Lakers not extending Kent Bazemore a qualifying offer to make him a restricted free agent so they could shave off like whatever, like $500,000 in cap space off his cap hold so they could make a full max offer to Carmelo Anthony in 2014. This is a Lakers podcast, damn it. And Kent Bazemore is a Lakers topic, and it's relevant today as it was in the summer of 2014. Don't at me.
They were run a bit different back then when they were doing that. Or how about this summer they maxed, maybe not maxed, but gave the huge deals to Dang and Mozgov.
Like $134 million for those two dudes. Like, first of all, they're still paying Luol Deng, but the fact that wasn't that long ago. It was the summer of 2016.
Yeah, no, it wasn't at all. But different times for the Lakers. Prohibitive favorites. What are you, I guess, last thing, league-wide? I want to ask this of you guys every week. Like, has anything changed your opinion? Has anyone changed your opinion on, like, what the landscape looks? I guess the Harden trade did, and we've talked about that some. But the West just looks overhyped to me in the middle. It's just the threats are not emerging beyond the Clippers.
Utah is sneaky to me. They have the best 3-point percentage in the league. They are a really good 3-point defensive team. They're a top five offense, I believe. Like, there's something there. You know, when they're at full strength, Conley's having a little bit of a resurgent year. You know, if they have Bogdanovich healthy in the playoffs, like, that's a team that, like, I could see making a run. But I still just see the gap between 1 and 2, and then even if they're 3, being
there's a
being
gap between 2 and 3. There's a gap.
I just don't. And listen, I felt this way last year, right? But I just don't see how anyone other than the Lakers and Clippers ends up in the Western Conference Finals, barring injury, barring, you know, a roster decimated by COVID. Like, I just, you know, and I, if assuming the Lakers and Clippers take care of their business, they will be favored all the way through until they meet in the Western Conference Finals. Yeah. And that's where I see. I have a hard time getting excited about any of the movement in the middle, or the fact that Denver's off to a slow start. They're sub 500 right now, or the fact that Phoenix has been the surprise team in the West. You know, it's interesting. It's going to make for some good playoff series down the road. But, you know, in terms of like trying to project what it actually means for the big picture of the season, you know, I just don't see it.
Denver's probably the story from a negative perspective early on in the West. I think they're like the 11 seed right now. They're 6-7. The Jeremy Grant loss is looking more important as he goes to Detroit and like looks every bit the $20 million per year, whatever he got. Player.
I mean, he's going to be an all-star this year in Detroit.
Yeah, he is. Michael Porter Jr., getting him back will help. He's been in COVID protocol for like 3 weeks now. And then Jamal Murray reverting to pre-bubble Jamal Murray as this like hot and cold player. It really, I mean, that's why they beat the Clippers. That's why they emerged as kind of a tough out, I would say, somewhat tough out for the Lakers in the West Finals. And maybe the playoff stage will bring that back out of him. But that's, to me, if Jamal Murray isn't that he was in the playoffs, that just takes one more thread off the board for the Lakers.
I want to reserve any judgment on the Bucks until we see the Thursday matchup and how that plays out. But for me, I think the only two continued developments, which, as you said, we've already been discussing, I do think that the Clippers, and you know, I don't really like talking about it to them because, you know, I do have a good knowledge of kind of what they're doing. Like, I think
unleash the hive.
I think they look like better than last season, at least offensively. You know, defensively, I still think they're bottom 10 right now. So, and most of that is because of that Dallas loss. But, you know, aside from that, like, they do look better. You know, Nicholas Batum has probably been the best minimum signing of the offseason. Serge Ibaka's fit in well. So, like, they to me are, you know, there is, I still think you put the Lakers number one in the West, number one overall, but the Clippers to me are looking more like the, you know, not only the clear number two in the West, but arguably the clear number two in the league. And then you have Brooklyn, where KD has been amazing. Like, KD has not missed a step really at all. You know, if anything, a half step at most.
If you didn't know he tore his Achilles, you wouldn't know he tore his Achilles. Like, he looks like the same player.
And theoretically, like, to have a chance to beat the Lakers, you're going to need your best player to be the best player in the series. And off the top of my head, the only two guys that I think are capable of matching or surpassing LeBron and AD in a 7-game series are Kevin Durant and Kawhi Leonard. And, you know, of course, I mean, the Lakers have two of those guys. So that's why you continue to favor the Lakers in any 7-game series. But,
and James Harden is the number two. This
version of Kevin Durant is capable of being the best player in a series with LeBron and AD. Now, will he do that? You know, time will tell. We'll see if they make the finals. We'll see what happens. But yeah, like, so that to me raises Brooklyn's ceiling clearly, where, you know, they probably have the highest ceiling in the East just because of that. So I look at Brooklyn, I look at the Clippers, I look at the Bucks. Outside of that, I see a clear gap between everybody else.
Why the hell didn't the Nets have PJ Tucker involved in that deal? I feel like they probably, if they could have, if they just asked, they probably could have got PJ Tucker, right? That wasn't going to stop that deal from going down. So that's what they need. They just need, they need backline defensive help. Now, whether that's an undersized PJ Tucker or some type of center on the buyout market or trade market, but they're not done maneuvering, as we've discussed. Yet we're still however many weeks into the season, and I don't know what Vegas says, but the Lakers remain, in my opinion, in most people's opinions, clear favorites. So, Bill?
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Forum Club. The Forum Club, a athletic NBA podcast production, produced by Tanika Smothers. I'm your host, Bill Oram, saying goodbye for now for Anthony Slater and Jovan Buha. I really got to work on my TV guy voice.